Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, prayer can change history. One of the favorite phrases of Italian Capuchin friar Padre Pio of Pietralcina. We talk to a Capuchin friar and author of a book on Padre Pio's spiritual reflections. And though observers may not agree with outgoing U.S. President George Bush's domestic or foreign policies, even his critics admit he will be leaving one very important and positive legacy. Millions of Catholics around the world are devoted to him, and thousands can thank him for providing dignified and professional health care when they had nowhere else to turn. Padre Pio of Pietralcina died on September 23, 1968, but his legacy looks likely to endure for decades to come. This humble Capuchin priest, who many will remember for bearing the stigmata, the visible signs of Christ's passion, spent most of his life in the southeastern Italian town of San Giovanni Rotondo. Made a saint by Pope John Paul II in 2002, Padre Pio helped build the Home for Relief from Suffering, a large hospital that treats patients from all over Italy and abroad for a wide variety of illnesses. Well, I sat down with Father Gianluigi Pasquale, a Franciscan Capuchin friar of Padre Pio's own order, and author of the book Secrets of a Soul, Padre Pio's Letters to His Spiritual Directors. Father Pasquale told me that he had never taken much of an interest in Padre Pio until he was asked by his superior to prepare a series of conferences on the Capuchin friar. Father Pasquale was living in Germany at the time, and his task was to prepare German pilgrims who were coming to Italy for the beatification celebrations for Padre Pio. He confided to me that he was really taken aback by his superior's order, but that it soon became a very personal passion as he learned more and more about this simple priest from Pietralcina.
I answered to the superior, Paolo Stervite, I don't know nothing about Padre Pio, because I never read nothing about him. And he told me, you have to start. And I asked, why? Because even though you are not keen on Padre Pio, you are an Italian man, and so you have the facilities and the abilities to read his writings. So I started to read the letters, the famous epistolario, the collection of his letters, and I prepared two sermons in German. And I give these two sermons in Liebfrauen, which is a very famous Catholic church in Frankfurt, from the Capuchins there. It's a sanctuary, a shrine, actually. And there was in the church a Jesuit father. I didn't know that there was a Jesuit father, von München, the director of the review Geist und Leben, which means in English life and spirituality. And he recorded my conference in German, and he printed it.
He printed it?
Yes, in this review. And with a very big surprise, when I came back here in Rome, I was in Rome also to finish my doctorate at the Gregorian University, I saw the two articles. And this article were read in Milan from the director of the Paulinist Publishers House in Milan, Dr. Elio Guerriero, and he called me, asking me, would you like to write some books about Padre Pio, because you have discovered the mystic of Padre Pio. That was my first link. And since then, I felt myself to be very, very protected from Padre Pio, very, very protected. I got in touch with him in a very, very deep way.
You say Padre Pio died in 1968. How old were you then? Were you even born?
I was born just a year before, 1967.
1967. Yes. You didn't have any way to know him except through these letters.
Exactly. And through these letters, I discovered two very particular characteristics of Padre Pio, that he has a very deep spirituality which is named mystic or mystagogic, which means to lead people with the possibilities to be in touch with God. That is the mystic. And I would say that Padre Pio could be in the future a doctor of the Church, but the main point, according to my point of view, which characterized Padre Pio is that it was the first priest in the history of the Church and also in the history of the world who was stigmatized, who has the stigmata. Because the first one, everybody knows, that was St. Francis of Assisi, and Padre Pio as Capuchin is also a Franciscan, but St. Francis of Assisi was not a priest, was a deacon. Afterwards, there was a poor clerk Capuchin, Santa Veronica Giuliani, who had the stigmata in the 17th century, but the first Catholic priest, the first priest in absolute way of thinking, was Padre Pio. That means, according with my theological point of view, that to be priest stigmatized for Padre Pio belongs to be a part of Christ suffering on the Holy Cross. Because a priest who has the stigmata is not like to be a normal man like St. Francis, which is also holy, or Santa Veronica Giuliani.
You said that you think that he could become a doctor of the Church. Why do you say that?
Normally, the Catholic Church declares somebody doctor of the Church when they have a very own particular spirituality. And Padre Pio, according to my theological point of view, has his own spirituality, which is to participate to the suffering, to the sufferings, to the penance with Jesus Christ on the Holy Cross. In fact, he received the stigmata or the wound on the 18 September 1918, just 4 days after the Feast of Elevation of the Holy Cross, which is on our calendar on 14th of September, and just 1 days before the 17th of September, when St. Francis received his first stigmata. And he was in the choir. After taking Holy Communion, he was alone, just in front of the Holy Cross, and he heard, as he has written in his letters, the voice of Jesus Christ saying, "Would you like to take part to my sufferings for the world, for the human being?" And he said, "Yes." And just in order to answer to your question, it happens during the First World War, 1918.
The First World War.
Exactly.
And he also lived through the Second World War. How did he live those two experiences?
In his letter, it is quite easy to find out, and it is quite understandable, that he participated with sufferings for the destruction. So many families were destroyed from this Second World War, and he participated with his silence. If we well remember what happened in the history of the Church for Padre Pio, in that years, the Congregation of the Holy Faith asked him to stay in silence starting from 1939 up to 1946. It is not interesting to realize that is just the time when the Second World War happened. So he, with his obedience to the Catholic Church, he participated, to be in silence, because he was asked not to hear more confession, not to celebrate the Holy Mass in public.
Because there were some doubts about his authenticity, right?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. With his obedience, deep obedience with the Catholic Church, he has always said, "I want to be obedient to the Catholic Church." The newspaper of the Holy See, L'Osservatore Romano, has written a very interesting article about these things, because Pope Benedict XVI has opened the old archive, the Archivio Segreto Vaticano.
The secret archives of the Vatican.
Yes, up to 1939. Mm-hmm. There is also a very good surprise and discovering that the Holy See has always had with Padre Pio a very protected behavior. The Holy See has always protected as soon as possible the Padre Pio pastoral service, and the apostolic visitator, who was a Carmelite, went to Padre Pio, and he has written a very interesting relationship. We can read the Osservatore Romano, in which he said Padre Pio is only a humble Franciscan, a true Capuchin, and a holy man. Which is, I think, is very important, because that is the voice and the report of the Holy See, not of our other kind of offices, mm-hmm. You know.
Did you have the opportunity to read any of the letters that Padre Pio wrote, perhaps during those war years?
Yes, the letters that Padre Pio has written in for his epistolarium, which are now collecting four big volumes. And about these letters, he was always saying, especially to families, men and women who has known during the confessions, to accept what could happen in their life, thinking that God, said Padre Pio, is doctor and medicine in the same time. Hmm. That is a wonderful expression that I learned from Padre Pio. So the main purpose which we can find out in his letters, I mean the letters of Padre Pio, is just that he was always saying to the families to accept what could happen, and then that our first strength and energy is the prayer. The prayer, as written Padre Pio, could change the world, could change the events, could change really the history. In one letter he has written that the history is written not from big or important politician, but from the humble people, from the good families, and especially from our prayer.
Father Gianluigi Pasquale is a Franciscan Capuchin friar and author of the book Secrets of a Soul, Padre Pio's letters to his spiritual directors. At the UN this past September, nations pledged close to $16 billion to help poor countries fight poverty, disease, and to assist them in agricultural development. A high-level meeting at the UN on September 25th brought together world leaders, private sector, and civil society partners to discuss ways to energize collaboration around the UN Millennium Development Goals. One of those goals is to halt the spread of HIV/AIDS by the year 2015. Well, of course, it's one thing to pledge money, quite another to actually make good on the promise. But one country that has made good on its unique promise to help stop AIDS in Africa is the United States. Though many observers have harsh words for outgoing President George Bush's domestic and foreign policies, even his critics admit he does leave an important and very positive legacy with the president's plan for emergency AIDS relief. Under this plan, for the past 5 years, the U.S. has almost single-handedly implemented the most ambitious project to combat AIDS, pouring into the African continent $15 billion for education and health treatment programs. Well, I spoke recently to U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Ambassador Mark Dybul for a rundown on the progress they've achieved and asked him if they'll meet the challenge to end AIDS by 2015.
The data from Africa, and Africa is important because two-thirds of the disease in the world is in Africa, which is rather extraordinary, has actually stabilized, and we've begun to see a decline across the continent. Some countries, substantial declines, 30%, 23% reductions in HIV rates. But it's still way too high. I mean, we don't want to just halt and reverse, because that halting would keep us at 30% of adult populations infected in some countries. We want to bring the rates down to remarkably lower levels. And there's great progress there. One of the things that's not in the Millennium Development Goals, because it's so new, is treatment. There is no Millennium Development Goal. And while we certainly want to prevent new infections, part of compassionate care, part of a human response, is to care for and treat those who are infected, because otherwise they'll die. And more than 20 million people have already died from this disease. And another 30 million will die if we don't intervene. And that's why the American people have responded in such a vigorous right way, not only to prevent new infections, but also to provide compassionate care and treatment for those already infected, and to care for the orphans that have been left behind as a result of the number of people who have died.
In Africa, what are the figures exactly of people infected and people who have actually contracted AIDS?
There are 33 million people about infected in the entire world, and two-thirds of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. So 20-some million people, 24, 25, 26 million people with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, two-thirds of the epidemic.
Now, I was reading a little bit of a UN AIDS report for 2007, and the number of people affected by HIV in sub-Saharan Africa peaked in the year 2000 and has slowly but, like you said, steadily diminished since then. Deaths from AIDS, on the other hand, peaked in 2005 and have only just begun to diminish. How do you explain this discrepancy of 5 years for between 2000 and 2005?
Well, most people with HIV actually do not become sick for 10 years. Only half of people start to become sick and die at a 10-year period. So there's a lag between when you become infected and the infection rate and the death rate, and that's expected. But we have started to see a decline in the death rate, and that's a very exciting thing, and a lot of that probably has to do with the expansion of treatment. When President Bush announced his emergency plan for AIDS relief, it was the first time anyone had really addressed this on a global scale. There were only 50,000 people in all of sub-Saharan Africa receiving treatment. Through March of this year, the American people supported treatment for 1.7 million people, and so we're starting to see those changes. The other piece of the death rate, and I think this is very important and not captured in that number, is the orphan crises.
Absolutely.
12 million orphans from HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. And we know that orphans have a threefold higher risk of death if they don't have a parent, because there's no one there to care for them. And just think about the next generation. With no parents, who's going to be there to care for the children? And HIV preferentially kills teachers. Two-thirds of teachers in Zambia were dying from HIV/AIDS. How do you educate the next generation? And so, you know, you talked about the Millennium Development Goals. Most of the Millennium Development Goals can't be reached in Africa, not just that HIV one, if we don't tackle HIV/AIDS. We can't do education. We can't tackle maternal and child health. We can't tackle overall death rates. One of the most exciting things we've seen, actually, is for the first time in a decade, because of HIV interventions in some of these countries, we're seeing increases in life expectancy and decreases in child mortality. Whereas before that, because of AIDS, we were seeing significant increases in child mortality and decreases in life expectancy. Life expectancy in Botswana went from 60 years to around 40 years because of HIV/AIDS. Extraordinary impact on societies. And AIDS is different than most diseases. It doesn't kill the very young and very old. It kills 15 to 50-year-olds, the most reproductive and productive part of society. So if you knock out that generation of individuals, it was looking pretty bleak for Africa. Now everything's changed. And what's changed most is there's hope. Hope has been recreated in Africa, and that's changing the whole dynamic.
How is this program implemented exactly? I know that you cooperate also with the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. In many instances. There are programs like the lay community Sant'Egidio, which has a very important structure mm-hmm. in Mozambique mm-hmm. where they're treating HIV and AIDS patients. How exactly are you implementing mm-hmm. this project?
We do, in fact, work with many Catholic and Christian and faith-based organizations, and that was intentional. I think one of the revolutionary aspects of this program, and actually how President Bush has approached development, I think is something fundamentally that people of faith understand, because it begins with the dignity and worth of every human life, and it begins with the belief in each person and their ability to rise above, own their lives, and do extraordinary things with a little support. And so we have fundamentally reached into the community to find those heroes otherwise ordinary people who will do heroic work with a little support, and they're the ones who are doing the work. So what we do is filter money down. 80% of our partners are local organizations, 80% of our partners, about 24% of them are faith-based organizations. Catholic Relief Services is one of our largest implementing partners. Sant'Egidio is engaged in a number of countries, but it's not just the ones you hear about. It's the very many small local organizations, and you've got to engage them. You know, 30 to 70% of healthcare in sub-Saharan Africa is provided by faith-based organizations. 30 to 70%. And how are you going to tackle this epidemic? And more than that, in every community, we have to change human behavior. We have to get people to respect themselves and respect others and act on that in socially and sexually responsible ways. And people listen to their leaders, including their faith leaders and their community leaders. And so we've got to get to them and get them engaged. And that's fundamentally what we've been doing, getting, as President Bush says, meeting people where they are. And that involves the community, and that often involves the faith community.
With the problems that the United States faces domestically, internationally, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on, why so much priority importance on AIDS in Africa?
Well, it begins with that fundamental belief which President Bush has expressed, but really reflects who the American people are. And that's why we have such strong bipartisan support. This isn't just a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's an issue for the American people. President Bush has always said, when he talks about this initiative and his other initiatives, you know, we've tripled development overall. This is a piece of a much bigger attempt to lift people up and support them. He always says, to whom much is given, much is required. That's where this comes from, and that should be something that resonates with many of the people who would be listening. He always says, to whom much is given, much is required. So whatever problems the United States has, whatever financial difficulties we are very wealthy people. We are very compassionate people, and so we have the capacity to do more. And on our Senate floor, as the renewal of our law was being discussed, several people raised this issue. You know, we have other problems, and the senators were very strong, and they said, look, we should never have to have a discussion of this versus that. We have the ability to do both. So that, I think, is there. The other reason is more and deeper. As we mentioned, HIV/AIDS knocks out a generation of parents, teachers, peacekeepers, healthcare workers, actually preferentially infects those people, workers, people are earning a living. So we're knocking out that generation, leaving a generation of orphans. That's creating a hopelessness. It's difficult to describe how hopeless most communities felt because of HIV/AIDS. Their weekends, streets were clogged with coffins going out to be buried. There was a pall over communities, a total sense of helplessness.
It sounds like you were there personally.
Yes, I have been many times. A sense of real hopelessness and helplessness. And as President Bush has said, that's a perfect breeding ground for fanaticism and instability. And the UN's General Assembly actually had only special session on HIV, on any disease was on HIV, and talked about the security risks of HIV/AIDS. So while this is fundamentally a humanitarian, to whom much is given, much is required initiative, there is a component of this is very important for peace and security as well.
What are the most important, well, the most effective means of combating the spread of HIV and AIDS?
Well, in terms of spread, which is the prevention, the most important thing is human and sexual responsibility. But it's also more complicated than that because we see transgenerational sex, older men preying on younger girls. We see transactional activity, people trying to get food and education for their children. So it's a very complicated issue. But the data tell us that delaying when you become sexually active, having social responsibility, has a significant impact on the epidemic. Reducing your partners, ideally having one partner to whom you are faithful throughout your life, both being HIV negative. And those are the things we know, the data are overwhelming, are effective, and we know that's the case. And we put a lot of emphasis on the need for that whole package. But you have to go deeper than that. You're really talking about getting to five-year-old children to teach them a different way of looking at themselves and looking at the world. Getting back to their own dignity and worth, teaching them to respect themselves, to respect others. That's the fundamental message. And if that is part of who they are, and if they understand that they are cared about and loved and important to society, that will change how they behave in society and change their relationships to others. We're already seeing changes in the way young boys treat young girls. We're seeing differences in how they perceive themselves, and that leads to a more socially responsible behavior. So it really is fundamentally changing how young people view themselves and how society views them as loved individuals who we believe are our future and are treated that way. And that's what's changing things. And that's where the hope is really coming from, the sense that we believe in you. It goes back to that fundamental principle, dignity and worth of every human life and belief in every person and every person's unique capabilities and supporting them. And if you do that, we'll actually tackle the epidemic.
So that you're saying, starting even before adolescence, when kids are as young as five and, you know, they're not even there yet.
Exactly right. Change mm-hmm. their social norms. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to change a 25-year-old's behavior. Mm-hmm. You've got to start when you're young. We learn this in smoking campaigns. We learn this in many other aspects of public health. And this is difficult. This is human, fundamental to human behavior. So you've got to start young. But it's that fundamental message of you have dignity and worth. We believe in you. That is fundamental in Africa to tell people we believe in you. And from presidents down to people in the community, they tell us that that's made as much a difference as the drugs. The fact that the people of the United States believe in them and care about them means a great deal to them.
But if the parents are dying, the grandparents are dying, and the teachers are dying, who is getting this message across?
That's where it comes to the full community. And this is one of the beautiful things of, for example, in Africa. Africa, they actually don't – the sense of an orphan is very unusual to them. They don't really have words for it because children aren't owned by a family. They're owned by the community. You are a child of a community. So the natural approach is for other family members or the community, if the family members are not available, to take care of a child. But that requires resources. Often it's the grandparents. You know, many of the grandparents are alive because it was the young. This disease has fundamentally been over the last 20 years. So it's the grannies who are often taking care of the kids, and we're working to support them. But it really is to build a social structure where there is that love and support in a community. Orphanage is something we actually don't have to do very much and try to avoid because we know kids will do better in their community. So that's the problem, though. We lost this generation, so we have to build it back up using all of the tools of the community, which means the faith sector, which means the private sector and community-based organizations.
2015 is right around the corner. Are we going to make that deadline?
Well, deadlines are, you know, things that we put into place for good reason to try to drive things. We had a five-year goal. President Bush set up a five-year goal. His emergency plan for AIDS relief, often called PEPFAR, President's Emergency Plan for AIDS, is the largest international health initiative in history ever for a single disease. We had five-year goals to support treatment for 2 million people, to support the prevention of 7 million new infections, which is 60% of infections in the countries we were working in, and to care for 10 million, including orphans and vulnerable children. We're going to meet those goals, and we're going to meet them within the year because that's when the 5 years is up. Our Congress has just set another five-year goal for us with the president's leadership, 3 million in treatment, 12 million infections averted, 12 million in care, including orphans and vulnerable children, and we're going to meet those too. So we are on track. The American people are on track to meet its commitments. I think one of the great tragedies here is currently the American people are providing 55% of all global resources for HIV/AIDS. 55%. As long as one country is doing that, we'll meet the goals we've set, which are substantial goals. But until the rest of the world responds to this epidemic, we cannot meet the goals because we don't have the resources. Global community has made commitments in the G8 and in other places, but we haven't met them. The United States has met them. A few other countries have. Others have not. So if we just meet our current commitments, we'd do pretty well. This is the most exciting thing. We talked about hopelessness. If you go to places, as I'm privileged to do, from six-month intervals, you see a hope coming that is unstoppable. Because we are supporting people at the community, there is a fundamental, palpable change in individuals, communities, entire countries. People who thought their lives were taken away from them have been given back to them. They call it the Lazarus effect, actually. That what they thought was absolute death and despair for their society and for people is now being given back to them. And that hope, when you create it, is unstoppable. It is more powerful than any money and more powerful than any program. And that is what will be the engine of change.
Ambassador Mark Dybul is the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.